Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest, and no question in this case, somebody here who went to Princeton and Harvard Medical School and published 50 scientific articles, and I'm building up his credibility because he's written a really important, mercifully short book, I want to say, as somebody who reads books all the time. That is not getting the attention I think it deserves. And I read his book at my producer, Josh Shearer's suggestion. I'm happy for it because I thought it's about time I thought about not only the opioid crisis, but thinking about the CDC, where Dr. Charles LeBaron, I hope I got it right, worked for 28 years. And his view of the official medical agency and what it does and how it sets out guidelines is really powerful. But what adds force to it is at one point where I got really hooked on this book, one of the requirements at the CDC is you had to do some real life experience out there, and he worked in a jail prison. And that I found is a very moving part of the book. And then you worked on an Indian reservation where you actually functioned as a doctor there, not just as the epidemiologist studying these things, as you had done. I shouldn't say not just, but getting into the field. And what I found fascinating about this book is, first of all, it's a page turner. Usually I think of doctors as people who can hardly write a prescription legibly. And it's very well written. But what really makes it so important is you really care about the outcome, you know, not, you know, the statistics, but the pain, the health, does it work? Don't kill the patient, don't harm the patient, and so forth. And I don't want to put words in your mouth. The title is Greed to Do Good. What is the subtitle again? I wrote it down before. Oh, The Untold Story of CDC's Disastrous War on Opiates. And tell me about the Greed to Do Good, this overview that you bring to it.
Well, it's a sort of tale of good intentions going wrong twice, actually. The way the good intentions went wrong back in the late 90s and the early 2000s was everybody decided that nobody should be in pain. No one should have any pain whatsoever. And there were pain scales going around. And the idea is if you walked into a doctor's office and you experienced any pain, it would be basically criminal of the doctor not to prescribe something to relieve you of your pain, which is a little curious because in medicine, you're supposed to go after the cause of the pain rather than the effect. However, that was promoted very actively by a bunch of folks who make money off selling opioids. And that story is relatively well known, that opioids were overprescribed, and they were prescribed to the point where 80% of opioids were being consumed by the U.S. In a global sense, where we only have about 5% of the population. People are getting opioids at a rate of about 90% for operations where in Europe, for instance, only 5% of people got opioids. And the result of this, you might call well-intentioned on some people's part to reduce the number of people who are in pain, result in a large population of people who became, in essence, legally addicted to opioids. Whereupon, as you might imagine, the number of overdoses also increased in parallel to the amount of prescriptions of opioids that are going on. And people finally scratched their head at CDC and said, what are we going to do about this? So they slammed the door shut on people getting legal opioids. Well, you can imagine what happens if you're opioid addicted to legal versions of opioids, and they slammed the door shut on that. There are a bunch of entrepreneurs south of the border who said, maybe there's a market share we can grab here. And they said, we can construct some really powerful opioids with some materials coming from China. And they start importing fentanyl and other comparably lethal drugs. Whereupon, as soon as CDC had decided to slam the door on legal opioids, there was an explosion of overdoses to the point where it quadrupled in about 7 years, reaching to the point where there are 100,000 deaths per year. And over the course of the first two decades of the 20th century, 1 million people had died of overdoses. And so again, these were two, in a sense, well-meaning but misguided interventions. One was to reduce the amount of pain in existence to zero, well-intentioned but misguided. And the second was, we're going to eliminate addiction and overdoses by slamming the door on safe versions of opioids. And in each case, matters went south. And here we are.
Well, as you point out in your book, though, it wasn't only, and maybe with the CDC, it was the greed to do good, but also there was the greed to make profit by pharmaceutical companies. And obviously, when you get into the illegal, even greater profit, perhaps. But I want to start with the pain, because actually I found that the book is divided into four sections. And I like that way of treating you, because you put yourself in the position of the patient. And the first part was about your back pain and your illness and so forth. And it's really compelling, because you're getting it not from a doctor saying, suck it up and live with it. It's, you know, you don't want to make the cure worse than the illness. But you experience the pain. You write about it very movingly, trying to struggle with it, the temptation to take more and so forth. But you gained a lot of wisdom about it and having to manage pain. So why don't we begin with chapter one, and then we'll go through the, I mean, section one, and they'll go through the four themes of the book. Because I think there's, I want to tell people, this is like 140 page book. Then there's about another 60 pages of citation, good information. It's very solid. But I just found it about the best way you can spend part of an afternoon reading it, you know. And on this show, I reviewed books and things that take, you know, take me up a week or 2 weeks to read. So I was grateful for that. But you, as I say, you have a real gift, I think, with the writing. And I haven't read another book I saw by you, your first year at Harvard Medical School, but I'm going to get a hold of it after we're done here. I'd like to know what that was like.
Also short, also in that zone where an afternoon will do it for you.
Yeah. But let's begin with the pain, because when you have pain, you want to manage it, whether legally or illegally, you know, or including drinking too much or whatever. And so it's really a good personal story there about how to deal with it, and then what might be the role of opiates positively.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's said in medical school, and it's absolutely true, you learn a lot more from your patients than you do from your books. But they fail to put one additional thing in. You learn much more by being a patient than you do from either of those other factors. And pain is a particularly enlightening event. This has been well known throughout spiritual history as well, that distress educates. And in my case, I had I think most people would consider to be major league pain. I had staphylococcal meningitis, collapsed a bunch of vertebrae, and on top of that, I got shingles, which is a ulcerative condition of the skin over about half of my torso, and it's all simultaneous. And it is remarkable when you're in the level of pain which I experience, how fundamental that experience seems to be in many ways, fundamental to your understanding of yourself, your understanding of the world around you. You develop a very interesting view of how the universe operates when you're in excruciating pain. It sounds metaphysical, and it is metaphysical, but believe me, it has a trivial aspect in that you realize that a pill can make it go away. but someone won't give you that pill, even though it's there. And you develop a remarkable view of human nature when that happens. And in effect, what happened to me and happens to many people who are in really severe pain is the CDC had developed a bunch of rules associated with who was allowed and who was not allowed to get pain medications. And it was remarkably instructive for me. And that was what motivated me to write the book about how pain is really a pretty extreme event when it's as strong as what I had. And it's a pretty extreme view that you develop of other human beings if that the remedy is withheld from you.
So, but you also, there was a serious illness. I think you have a statistic in there that there was a 50% death rate of serious.
Yeah, about right. I survived that. And I ultimately ended up on a level of narcotics, which would, over time, create about 50% risk of ongoing need for narcotics. Yeah. I managed to get off those. So I kind of had luck. I had luck. I survived physically, and I had luck in that I survived the adverse events of the medication. So one of the things I mentioned in there is it's good to have good luck. Good luck in the sense that I got medical care. Other people don't have access to medical care. I had good luck in that I come from a good sociologic strata in which I have the support of economic and personal. And I had probably good accidental biologics in that I never got high off this stuff.
Yeah,
I never felt euphoria. I never felt anything. As far as I'm concerned, it was a medication to relieve pain. And I never felt any of the other events that psychological events that are associated with ongoing use. So
let me go from that to the second part of your book, the capacity for fanaticism. How does that relate? So here you are from being the patient, and now you're describing your experience of being at the central health organization, revered most of the time, at least before the pandemic, and now Donald Trump, but still it was revered. And what did you mean by that, the capacity for fanaticism?
Well, I allowed myself to draw the analogy between what I had done at CDC and what CDC was trying to do with opioids. At CDC, things are very different right now. A different program would be required to examine what's going on at CDC. But we're serious folks at CDC. And we like to get rid of pathogens. And in my case, we basically got rid of measles in the United States. You'll note that measles is making a resurgence under the current regime. And we had previously gotten rid of smallpox. We'd worked on a bunch of other things. So we're serious folks about when we regard a pathogen as preying upon the public and we want to get rid of it. Where the problem becomes is when you apply the pathogen notion to a medication like opioids. And to some extent, if you take that lens and view opioids as if they were an infectious agent, there's some seductiveness to it because they basically are imported. In effect, it becomes a communicable disease. If other people are taking opioids, you tend to do so. But if you regard them as a infectious disease that you need to eradicate, no one ever needed a little bit of smallpox to get along in life. No one ever needed a little bit of measles to survive. But opioids are an essential medication for survival in many ways. And the extent to which we applied the same degree of seriousness of purpose, in a sense, the capacity for fanaticism to opioids, created the problem of illegalization being normalized and then overdoses being the consequences.
Well, that is, but when you say fanaticism, I mean, they really messed up a lot of people's lives, and you experienced some of that, I witnessed, when you worked in the prison, right?
Right.
One example of a young man, he went in there, 20-something, for a pocket full of what they said was a lot of drugs, and he's going to be there till he's in his early 50s. And, you know, and that, just the sort of carelessness of the way we mix up that which we should ban, and if we do ban it, how to ban it, and whose choice it is. I mean, it's a very powerful eyewitness in your book, and sort of a madness to it. I don't know. I don't want to, again, put ideas or words in your mouth, but that's what has struck me as a reader. You know, it's kind of what's going on. And, you know, and it was racially based, too. I think the one prison you were in, there was like 80% people were African Americans.
Exactly right. Yeah, the one claim I'll make for my book, you know, is said in medicine that you're either an inch deep and a mile wide, or you're a mile deep and an inch wide. You're either a hyper-specialist or a hyper-generalist. In my case, for this book, I will make the claim for uniqueness in that I had a variety of experiences, which at least to my knowledge, no one else has published. I have had extreme pain that required opioids for long periods of time. I've treated populations in Appalachia where the highest rates of addiction and overdose are present. I've worked in the prison system where so many people have been incarcerated. We have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. And so I, in a sense, know the situation from a great deal of breadth. I don't claim to know the situation from the same degree of depth that a opioid treatment specialist would, but I have the sense that I know the situation from a breadth. And what you're bringing out is the other aspect of what's happened with opioids, which is basically the notion that if you make a war on supply, if you go after the supply, the demand will go away. Well, the difficulty is there's no evidence that that's been the case. And our war on supply is basically a war on poor people, because we're not arresting the people in Purdue, the Sacklers. The Sacklers have a wing of the Metropolitan Museum. They don't have they're not in a wing of the federal pen. But the people who are trying to sell a couple grams of something, they end up with a mandatory minimum. And one of the things that was an experience working in the federal penitentiary, that was remarkable to see how many lives were being ruined by the supply side aspect of the thing. Yeah, we get El Chapo once in a while, or we get the Sacklers to give up $1 billion or something. But the real casualties are the people at the bottom, who end up going in their 20s, not coming out until their 50s, because they had a pocket full of some stuff they were trying to sell.
You know, it's interesting because that's an issue right now with the Trump administration between the United States and China over fentanyl and so forth. It's a big issue with Mexico, and it's dominating the whole discussion. I mean, maybe we should talk a little bit about that.
Well, it is interesting because that's one aspect that I haven't had too much to deal with, so I can't speak to it. I haven't been a law enforcement officer. I may have had all these other hats, but I haven't arrested people at the border. But it's an enormously futile to run around and say that we're going to impose, 80% tariffs on Mexico bringing in cars, and that's somehow going to reduce the fentanyl that's coming in. There's no evidence that would be the case. And so far, all our efforts at preventing fentanyl from coming in across the border have been largely futile because the demand is very, very strong here. And all you need to get across the border is something equivalent of a 12-pack of beer, of an even more potent opioid than fentanyl. It's carfentanil. If you bring in a basically the equivalent of a 12-pack of beer in a false bottom of an 18-wheeler, that's enough to overdose every man, woman, and child in the United States. So it is basically impossible to prevent drugs coming in. Where you can prevent the drugs coming in is cease to have the demand, the level that we have. And we're willing to spend billions, particularly in tariffs, on creating obstacles to the supply, which cannot be done. You're taking basically a paperclip to a rising tide. And we don't spend a cent on the treatments and other things that are necessary to reduce the demand.
So why, you know, again, speaking from your experience in, I mean, it's a long time, 28 years to be at the CDC.
Yeah, right.
And you had, you know, you were honored there. You're not some angry dissident or something. You know, you're a great success story. I mean, you know, we grew up in the Bronx, not far
yeah.
from each other. And you got into the special gifted high school. You got into Princeton. You got to Harvard. You got the credentials. You published in the papers. And what I loved about your book, I got to keep pushing this book because I really just think it's a terrific book. And Greed to Do Good: The Untold Story of the CDC's Disastrous War on Opiates. And I, you know, there's one book you read about this. This is the one. And because there's a humanity to it, you know, you're not preaching, you're not, you know, like Robert Kennedy. Now he's got the answers and everything. He knows it should be this way. And then Donald Trump shows it should be another way. You just got open eyes there. You're doing what, you know, any honest observer should do. And you say, hey, this is not working, or these people are, you know, and the CDC, you talk about how they drew up their guidelines and that it wasn't really good science. I think that's chapter three, isn't it? Right? Yeah, part three is about poor science, shoddy work, and it's not fact-driven. How does that happen?
Well, it's interesting how it would happen. What happens is there is an impatience in public health. When you see a rising tide of overdoses, you tend to say, I can't just sit here. I have to do something. And there's a danger to just doing something. Because in the case of public health, yes, sometimes you have to respond on plausibility alone. And the plausibility here is, you know, the drug companies promoted these drugs and people are taking them like crazy. We got to cut off this promotion of drugs by drug companies. Sounds good. That basically what you'd say the motivation is. The difficulty is the demand has been created. And addiction is a very, very powerful demand. It's very hard to erase it merely by edict. And the evidence that merely now just telling doctors they can't prescribe opioids is going to correct the problem. All it did is displace it into the illegal system where it became much more, the demand became much more dangerous. And there's no dishonor to operating quickly on plausibility without too much data, because sometimes you have to react. Where the difficulty is when things are ambiguous in the data, it is your obligation to constantly query the outcome. Am I doing good or am I doing harm? Now, there's greed to do good in the sense that people wanted to do something right on a plausibility basis. Drug companies are really addicting everybody. We got to stop them. With that, however, you need to examine the consequences of your own behavior. Did this have any effect that was beneficial? And when you get a doubling of overdoses after your intervention is applied, it behooves you to say, you know, are we doing more harm than good? And what should we be doing? And that was not done. And this comes back, Robert, to what you're talking about, the capacity for fanaticism. A characteristic of fanaticism in contrast to what you would call ethical medicine, is, yeah, this was a good medication. I did it as best I could, but the patient got worse. I got to reconsider my strategy. And unfortunately, for basically 6 or 7 years, while the overdose rate kept going up to the point where it is ultimately going to kill 1 million people in a decade, nothing was done to back off. And it just became, in essence, a fanatical activity rather than a medical activity.
And as you predict in your book, another million will die in the next period. It's not getting better.
Well, it's interesting how that thing. Recently, for reasons which aren't clear, and I would love to think that it represents, so CDC backed off slightly on its medication recommendations about a year and a half ago. And thereafter, the rate of overdoses has gone down somewhat, about 20% down. And people have, you can't believe how much celebration there's been over that. And of course, I celebrate people not dying like anybody else. But what that means, instead of 100,000 doses, 100,000 overdoses a year, we have 87,000. Okay, that's good. I'm glad it went down. That means in order to kill off another million people, we'll do it in 12 years instead of in 10. That isn't just the kind of success you'd usually break out the champagne for.
Well, you know, it's interesting, this idea of the physician do no harm and being, you know, having, your book has great modesty to its essential style. You don't claim, you are a well-educated doctor, obviously, of great experience, but you don't claim you're the expert on every aspect. You don't claim you have the answer. And there's a great sense of humility, which I really loved, coming from a highly trained, experienced professional, no more so than in the fourth section when you talk about Native American. And I was just thinking of and work on a reservation. I was just thinking when we were growing up in the Bronx, you know, and even though there had been strong Native cultures here before colonization in New York and so forth, people forget the Bronx of our time was also thought to be a place of farms and even some agriculture. But nonetheless, there was absolutely no sense of self-criticism of the whole American expansionist adventure that we represented enlightenment, we represented white America, represented civilization and so forth. And that last section of your book, why don't you talk about it, your work there, because it really was quite enlightening to me as a reader.
Well, it was enlightening to me as a physician. Basically, the call went out to members of the U.S. Public Health Service, of which I was a member. Hey, we got a crisis going on up in this particular they don't like calling a reservation because it wasn't technically a reservation. It was a area that they had, and they had Indian Health Service, however, a hospital there. So I went up, and the place was in total chaos, quite correctly a crisis, but it was an ongoing crisis. And in that crisis, opioids were being distributed right, left, and center because there was no coordination whatsoever. And the interesting thing for me, having worked there for about 20 years periodically, is the tribe took over ultimately, and things improved so much when the tribe was running it than when we, the Indian Health Service, were running it. And it was kind of remarkable. Now, some of that arose from in a sense, an ambiguous situation. They opened a casino, which there had been a lot of debate as to whether they should have a casino there. But they got a casino, and the casino basically, as someone says, a casino is a tax on the mathematically challenged. Basically, what it is you got a whole bunch of white people coming in, spending their money irrationally, and giving the tribe a whole bunch of cash. And then the question is, what is the casino cash going to do with it? And remarkably enough, the tribe, which is very different from the rest of us, they said, okay, should we just distribute it and everybody gets, quote, basically several thousand? They said, no, we'll invest it. You know, we'll invest it in the schools, and we'll invest it, in this case, in the hospital. And they built a very, very nice hospital, and they built up very good systems that reduced the amount of really bad opioid prescription to very little. What was the difficulty? The difficulty was that they were able to do that, but they, like the rest of the United States, did not invest, which is very expensive, in decreasing the already existent demand, the addiction level that was in the population. And needless to say, there was a gigantic enterprise surrounding the reservation, this Appalachia, where there was plenty of illegal opioids coming in. So they were able to clean up the act in the hospital, but they couldn't clean up the United States' act and what was going on outside of them. And in a sense, it represents the triumph and the tragedy of the whole situation, that they couldn't cure us. They could cure themselves, but they couldn't cure the rest of us.
You know, I'm going to conclude this, but the book, let me say it again. Greed to do good. Wow, that's so much of U.S. policy since we were kids in the Bronx. The greed to do good. Meddling, the untold story of CDC's disastrous war on opiates. And what I think makes this book really a great model, and I hope we can do a little bit to improve sales, it really should be read, is that you abandon the pretense of the arrogant professional. And you are actually looking there and say, wait a minute, I'm here as a doctor in this prison, or I'm here working on this reservation, or I'm here in this bureaucracy. And how is it affecting ordinary people? How is it really working out? And, you know, who's my model in journalism is I always want to know who's getting screwed and who's doing the screwing, you know. And you're very agnostic about it. I mean, the book just has a certain really wonderful honesty to it. You don't claim you know everything. You don't claim you have all the answers, but you sure have a good bull detector. You know, you know what, well, this is not working. You know, why are these young people being locked up in this prison? Who was it doing any good? Because he had the wrong stuff in his pocket that was somebody else was, that they were selling. You know, what's to be gained by keeping him here? I don't know. That stuck with me as an image. You know, just always going to be there another 20 years. He hopes his girlfriend will still love him when he comes out. I mean, it was so poignant, the description. So anyway, I want to recommend the book. Get it. Hopefully it's some independent stores, but you can get it on Amazon. Greed to Do Good, Dr. Charles Le Baron. That's a very fancy name there, but he's a guy from the Bronx like I am, so I'm want to help him out here. Well, that's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. See you next week. But I want to thanks to Joshua Sheer, our producer, who got me to read this book. I didn't even know it was out. I think it's terrific. And Diego Ramos, who writes the introduction and is our managing editor at Sheer Post. Max Jones, who does the video, which seems to get more people to watch these things than just the audio alone. And I want to say thanks to Integrity Media, founded by a very good criminal lawyer in Chicago, and Len Greenwald, Len Goodman, for providing some funding for this, and the JKW Foundation in memory of Gene Stein, a very independent writer, for helping out as well. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence.